You're listening to EA Radio. I'm Afterburner Al, and joining me in the studio is Mac McClellan of Flying Magazine and Tom Haynes, the editor of AOPA Pilot. And this is the Aviation Journalist Roundtable. Also invited to the table was David Hirschman, and he should be joining us. First, let's talk about some of the most wanted safety improvements that the NTSB has put out. It seems like they do a lot of research, and they kind of change rules. His first was you break... Yes, let's look at icing boots first and say, well, you break it off right away. No, you got to wait for a half inch. Now they're back to the first sign of ice, you break it off. Where are we at with icing research as far as what we should believe and what we should do?
Well, I think where we are is that there is no perfect solution for general aviation airplanes particularly. And I expect to see a resurgence of boots. We had been in a phase here where TKS, with its fluid, anti-ice fluid, seemed to be a more predictable and perhaps lower cost solution. Actually, the boots now are quite competitive. Part of the reason for what you mentioned, this controversy over waiting for a buildup versus operating the boots at the first sign of ice, is change in the technology of the boots. The inflation tubes in the boots are much smaller, much closer together. The materials are thinner, so the boot can snap quickly compared to the boots of the 40s and 50s when this other theory of waiting for ice to build before breaking it off. So I think perhaps in the single-engine jets and some of the other higher-performance airplanes, we're going to see a newer, high-tech, thin boot that can maintain the shape of the airfoil. Make a comeback and be, I think, quite reliable.
Tom, what do you think about the TKS system?
Well, certainly the advantages to both, but the TKS system obviously has a limitation in that there's only a certain amount of fluid on board the airplane, and when that's gone, you're suddenly out of options, and so the boots, presuming they continue to work, provide continuous protection. But at the end of the day, of course, none of them are 100% protection, because we've seen airliners with, you know, presumably the most sophisticated anti-ice and DA systems available brought down by icing, although not in recent years. There's another technology out there that's being looked at, was the one that Columbia was looking at, the heated wing for the Columbia, and I know that since Cessna has bought that product line, they're continuing to look at it too. I think they're certainly looking at making TKS probably standard on the airplane pretty quickly, but they are continuing to explore the heated wing, which has been a desire in the aviation market for a very long time, because it brings the advantage of continuous supply, unlike the TKS system. But it certainly takes a lot of power to do that, so you need a big honking alternator on there, and that raises its own questions of weight and reliability and that sort of thing.
Well, I know that certainly manufacturers are trying to throw as much technology as they can at it, but these safety improvements are mostly aimed at the FAA. Should the FAA respond in a technical way or more in a cultural way to pilots and crews and how they respond to icing?
Well, I think that the concept of certifying for known ice is analogous to certifying for flight in a thunderstorm. Now, you might live through a few thunderstorms, but you certainly won't make it through all of them. And that's true with icing. By the very definition of severe icing, is icing that cannot be controlled by the existing approved ice system. So I think we need to have a system that works as well as possible, but not continue to spread this fallacy that it is capable of handling the worst that Mother Nature can throw, particularly in light airplanes. Icing in jets is a problem. It's an important issue, but nothing that significant, because of the extra power and the ability to climb quickly and even to heat the air with the ram rise. The real focus needs to be on propeller airplanes, and so we need to understand that no matter what technology is on there, you have to escape ice and you have to do your best to avoid it.
The other thing that needs to be done is both pilot education, and there's some effort out there, and the second one is simply better, more research on where icing is and how to distribute that information to pilots more effectively. Ideally, in the cockpit, you would be able to get a much better real-time understanding of where the icing is and how to avoid it, and really accurate information. At this point, the information is not very accurate. So end up with these, you know, huge areas covered where there's potential of icing, and then pilots are confused about what to do and how to get there.
I would agree that I think that I would place it more. I mean, yes, the FAA certainly has a big burden, both in the technological side and getting education out there. And certainly I've seen a lot of research over the years, but it's still on the onus of the people who operate the airplanes, because there are so many ways to avoid these potential problems. And you're right about the fact that prop airplanes, whether they be piston or even turboprops, are somewhat underpowered. And that's where everybody's getting in trouble. They catch a load and they don't get out in time. And yes, the turbojets are most of the time able to power out of that stuff, or at least escape to more favorable conditions. The big elephant in the room right now is runway safety, though. And it just seems like there's been this big push, and then you hear about at some of the major airports where there's been problems with managers pushing controllers to the limits. How do you think the FAA has responded to the runway safety problem?
Well, they've been aggressive really over the last decade or more in putting together some industry teams to help both understand where the problems are and what's causing runway incursions, and then to also educate pilots. I know that our Air Safety Foundation, for example, has done quite a number of courses and a lot of outreach to help pilots understand what their responsibility is, how to question or when to question an FAA clearance, and if you don't understand it, make sure you stop and get clarification on what it is. Ask for progressive instructions if you're unsure. But there still needs to be clarifications of the regulations when you're cleared to taxi to a runway, and that allows you to cross another runway. I mean, technically that's allowed if you're given the clearance, and you know, if it's phrased that way. But it really causes confusion on a lot of pilots' parts because they're not sure, and we've seen situations where that's led to an accident because people thought they were cleared across a runway, or a controller thought they'd issued it correctly and in fact didn't, or the pilot misunderstood. So there's probably some cleanup of some phraseology could do that and make it clearer. And then the other one is technology, the ability for controllers to manage lights at the end of the runway or at intersections. VASIs have been talking about anytime any airplane crosses a threshold onto an active runway, that the VASI lights start flashing or something like that until to alert a pilot or an aircraft that might be on approach. And then after some period of time of seconds, or when the airplane on the runway crosses another switch buried in the pavement at, you know, 500 feet down the runway or something, it switches the VASIs back to steady. So there are opportunities out there, but it's pretty complex. Runway layouts at airports across the country.
Some
are very simple.
Yeah, CTAC, they still haven't been able to solve that one runway.
Yeah, some of them are so incredibly confusing. Yeah. So,
and that's just a taxiway, I should say. That taxiway has been painted about five different ways, and they still can't seem to solve how to get pilots from lining up and actually touching down on that particular taxiway. Yeah. One thing I saw in the my last simulator course was the actual stoplights, the embedded in across there that are on until they turn them off. And I thought, you know, that's, everybody knows about stoplights and go lights, and I'd say that's even more effective than those alternating flashing yellow lights, which seem to blend into people's psyche when they're taxiing around at night.
Yeah, the best thing we have so far, I mean, the other technology like turning on and off lights, a traffic light style, would be better, although it still takes no mistakes by the controller as well as no mistakes by the crew. I like the dashed lines for the last, I think it's 75 feet, that surround the center line as you approach a runway intersection. And anybody who operates professionally looks at the center line. You want your nose wheel to be on it, so it's exactly where you're looking. And it's just a reminder, and it gives you several seconds of, aha, here comes a runway, and am I cleared to cross or cleared to enter that runway? So to me, that of all the things FAA's done so far that's actually in service, that has been the most useful.
I would agree with that. I think it's kind of, that's caught my eye several times. You always look for that red stop sign, but I tell you, it gives you a nice warning. It brings you right back in case you get distracted with whatever else is going on.
Well, the other signs and the flashing lights are to the side. Mm-hmm. And you can look around and taxi accurately, but not much. If you want to be precise when you're taxiing, you really have to look at the center line, because our airplanes are not very directionally stable compared to, say, an automobile. And they're anxious to wander off, so it takes attention to keep that nose wheel on the center line. And so those dots, those stripes, are exactly where you're looking if you are flying and taxiing correctly.
And one last thing, and we'll talk briefly about it. Of course, a lot of people would argue that the FAA and others have talked too briefly about fatigue, especially in professional crews, but if we can apply it to general aviation and those who fly their own airplanes for pleasure or for their own business, the fact that people don't realize that, you know, you can't pull over, and sometimes it gets, it catches up to you before you know it. Have either of you in your publications addressed fatigue among general aviation pilots, other than, you know, the I'm safe and just the normal checklist that people go through?
We've, you know, touched on that topic, of course, many times, you know, over many years, because it's been an evergreen concern. And the NTSB blows hot and cold, and, you know, they've blamed some accidents on fatigue, where clearly the crew made errors. And who knows why they made errors, but that could have been a contributing factor. It's much more difficult when you fly for your own reasons, because there are no rules, there are no even guidelines of how much rest you should have had before you did something. Now, forget the last flight. You went to a business meeting or whatever the purpose of your trip was. So I think it's the most challenging for an individual, because we make it up as we go along. I think I can speak for all of us that I have a sliding scale of risk, and the riskiest is when I'm by myself. That sounds silly, but I'm willing to take chances with my life that I wouldn't with anybody else. Then perhaps if it's a relative, then of course there's a lower risk. Strangers or people that I might be carrying on a purposeful trip, that would be, I would make it the minimum, absolute minimum risk. So the danger to me lies when we're just making up our own minds for our own selves. And you can see it happens with business jet crews. The crew-only accidents where they're deadheading someplace are out of proportion with the amount of flying that happens. Again, proving that we pilots, we're willing to do things when there's nobody else on board that we would never subject a passenger to.
We have more to talk about on the Aviation Journalist Roundtable. We'll be back in just a moment. 89 degrees and a partly cloudy skies. You're listening to EAA Radio.